This is HDFC 2, Unit 5, Part 5. This is the second half. If the first half doesn't exist or is really short, it's because of the battery died on my antique iPod Nano. I'm just telling you that now because I'm recording this. So's you know. Okay, let's talk about abortions, both therapeutic and elective. So, lots and lots of abortions that happen worldwide. About 10 to 20 million are performed illegally. And I think sometimes what pro-lifers don't understand, well, I mean, wouldn't change the minds of pro-lifers, but when women have to seek abortions illegally, it means more complications and hospitalizations and additional cost to the overall healthcare system. But not that that's a consideration for someone who has pro-life beliefs. But, so abortions, just for your interest, I'm not going to test you on this, but when they're performed 1 to 2 weeks after conception, they're considered termed menstrual extractions. Prior to 9 weeks from the last menstrual period are performed surgically or medically. And 9 to 14 weeks are performed by dilatation, suction, curettage. And then after 14 weeks are performed surgically by dilatation and evacuation procedure. You might be thinking, like, what's the incidence of abortions beyond 14 weeks? And I don't know the answer to that. So post-abortion complications, I've had one in my entire career, and unfortunately it was a really close friend of mine who had some products, some conception that remained after her elective abortion, and I didn't even know she was pregnant, but we'd had many, many conversations about her rocky relationship with her boyfriend, and then we got a call to the bathroom in our building, and she had lost a significant amount of blood, a lot of blood on that bathroom floor, and we gave her 2 liters of crystalloids, took her to the hospital, she went straight to surgery. She got, I think, about 14, 15 units of blood during surgery, so she lost a lot. But the triad for post-abortion complications include pain, bleeding, and low-grade fever, usually the result of retained products of conception, and can lead to excessive hemorrhage and shock, coagulopathy. You'll recall coagulopathy is where you get an inappropriate activation of the clotting cascade, and most often it's what they call a consumptive coagulopathy, where the clotting factors are consumed inappropriately. And the result of coagulopathy is that when the capillaries break down, they don't have the ability to repair, so they leak. And so people in the, if you haven't been in the ICU yet, once you go into the intensive care unit, ask about patients with coagulopathy, and just ask one of the nurses, can you tell me about coagulopathy? What is it? Do all ICU patients develop coagulopathies? And how do you manage it? Because you won't see it in the field. Typical complaints include lower mid-abdominal pain. There may be uterine perforation that would give you increased abdominal pain, bowel injury, abdominal pain, fever, blood and stool, nausea, vomiting. As a general rule, whenever you're dealing with anyone with abdominal pain, we always ask about peeing and pooping. Always. Any difficulty peeing? Is it painful peeing? Increased frequency of peeing? Any blood in your pee? How about pooping? Are you having normal bowel movements? Are they solid stools, watery stools, bloody stools? Are you going more frequently, less frequently? So anything to do with the abdomen, we ask about micturition and defecation. Micturition being urination, defecation being the poopy thing. Septic abortion would include symptoms like fever, chills, abdominal pain, vaginal bleeding. And then failed abortion would be continued intrauterine or ectopic pregnancy. So post-abortion management, whether it's therapeutic or elective, the risks the big risk is hemorrhage. And there's not much we can do about hemorrhage control, but we have to think about things like IV access and fluid resuscitation. So we treat for shock, PRN, SpO2, O2, the usual. Just think if in a hypovolemic patient, like a CO poisoning patient, they'll have a falsely high oxygen saturation because they've got, if they're losing blood, they're losing oxygen carrying capacity. So what little they have may be 100% saturated, but they may benefit from O2 that dissolves in blood plasma. Yeah.
So I'm curious, I know that with my mother, when she was pregnant with me, she went to sepsis.
Yeah.
And had to be admitted to the hospital, and she had a C-section. I was born 7 weeks early.
Yeah.
If she hadn't done that, is there a chance that she could have had a septic abortion?
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of complications that could have happened, either septic abortion or just, you know, damage to the fetus, brain damage, other damage, death of mom, death of baby, all those sorts of things. So fluid resuscitation, PRN. Now, one of the other potential complications that we need to anticipate with pregnant patients is preeclampsia and eclampsia means seizure, preeclampsia means pre-seizure, and preeclampsia are patients who during pregnancy are typically hypertensive. That's one of the bigger issues. So they're hypertensive, they may have some other complications of pregnancy. So it's the most common hypertensive disorder, accounting for 50 to 70%. Now, it doesn't mean that every single pregnant patient who has high blood pressure is preeclamptic. It just means that if their pressure is unusually high, like well above 140 on 90, then they may be preeclamptic, so there's a risk of seizure. So just keep that in mind. It's also referred to as toxemia in pregnancy, and so you might hear saying the patient's toxemic or the patient's preeclamptic. The etiology is not clear, but one hypothesis is that placental dysfunction may initiate a system of vasospasm and ischemia and thrombosis, eventually changes to the maternal organs. And occurs after 20 weeks gestation. Now, patients may be pregnant and have a pre-existing history of hypertension, in which case, they're already hypertensive. It's one of the most common causes of perinatal morbidity and mortality. So mild preeclampsia would be typically increases in systolic of 30 millimeters of mercury and increases in diastolic of 15. So to an absolute reading of 140 on 90, that's mild. I wouldn't worry too much about mild. They may have some mild peripheral edema, some headaches. If they get their urine checked, they may have some protein in their urine. Severe eclampsia, on the other hand, we're looking at systolics above 160, diastolics above 110. And these are the patients who are at risk of seizure, right? So if patients usually know their diagnosis, and you might even get the information over dispatch, you're called to a 30-year-old female who's 24 weeks gestation, she's pre-eclamptic. To me, that means get there fast, get out of there fast. When I worked air ambulance, sometimes we adopted the modified motto of jet fighter pilots, move in quickly, make the kill, get out quickly, minus the kill part. Headache is common, visual disturbances can occur, confusion, all of this related to the high blood pressure and the consequent elevated intracranial pressure. Abdominal pain, if they have it, typically presents right upper quadrant. What's oliguria? Has to do with pee. Yeah.
Is it protein in urine?
It's not protein, no. What's anuria? What's that?
I thought urine output.
Okay, what?
That is less than
1
milliliter per
kilogram. Yeah, so anuria means basically no urine output. Polyuria, what would that be?
Polycystinuria?
excessive urine output. So if anuria is nothing and polyuria is too much, what do you think oliguria is? Yeah, scant. They call it scant urine output. Minimal urine output.
That's what oliguria is.
Good.
Okay. Peripheral edema, pulmonary edema would be another one. Some of these signs would be severe. Like, you should be really worried if this patient's got a headache, visual disturbances, and pulmonary edema. Peripheral edema, common in pregnancy. I don't worry too much about that. But systolic pressure is above 160, diastolic is above 110. That would scare the bejeebers out of me. It's like, let's go now. Let's not waste any time. So management is basically supportive care. There's really nothing for us to do except get them to the hospital and hope that they don't go into seizure on us. So SpO2, ECG, O2, just PRN. There's really nothing else. Eclampsia means seizure and or coma in pregnancy. So preeclampsia may lead to eclampsia. ACPs will treat it the same as any other seizure. They'll treat it with midazolam. Whether you get the seizure under control is another thing. But the only thing that truly will stop eclampsia is delivery of the baby. And sometimes that doesn't even do the trick. We usually deliver the baby. It doesn't mean, you know, we pull out the shears and try a C-section on the scene. I shouldn't even plant that seed in your minds. You know, have you ever heard the expression, give positive feedback? Yeah, you know that. Did you know that it doesn't actually mean give praise? Let me give you the flip. Like, it does mean give praise, but it doesn't mean exclusively give praise. Negative feedback is not criticism. Negative feedback is kind of a don't do this. Negative reinforcement is actually not give criticism. Negative reinforcement in education actually means doing something like, if you do really well on this assignment, no test for you because you did so well on this assignment. That's negative reinforcement. Yeah, it's a better approach. But positive reinforcement means keeping things in the positive. I'll give you an example. I don't know why I'm digressing, but there's a guy who teaches policing. But on the side, he takes people dune buggy riding on the sands, right, in British Columbia. And he used to tell people, if the dune buggy rolls, don't reach out to break your fall, because you're going to break your arm. But people continue to reach out and break their fall. So that's negative criticism or negative reinforcement, or what people perceived as negative reinforcement. Positive reinforcement is, if your dune buggy is going to roll, bring your arms in to your chest and hold them like that, you know, or keep one arm in the steering wheel, but bring your arms in. And people are more likely to remember bring your arms in, because if you say don't extend your arm, they forget the don't and they just extend their arm. So if you say bring your arms in, that's what they'll remember to do. So. Occurs in about 0.2% of pregnancies. It is life-threatening. Can lead to intracranial hemorrhage. That's a major cause of maternal death. Maternal death equals fetal death. So management is supportive. Seizures, make sure you oxygenate them well, so non-rebreather their mask. Open the airways best you can. Seizure patients will turn blue very quickly. They'll go cyanose, just boom, like that. It's frightening to see. And they'll gasp, and they'll be combative, and they'll be difficult to manage, and you want to get a non-rebreather on as fast as you can at a 15-liter flow, and oxygenate them, and have someone try to hold the jaw open a little bit and prepare them for transport and get the hell out of there. Don't waste any time on scene. Right, if you call for ACP backup, don't delay scene time for ACPs to arrive. ACPs can meet you in the driveway, they can meet you in the back of the ambulance, they can meet you a block away, but if you delay scene time, it means brain death. When in a seizure, your brain metabolism increases 100-fold, and every second that passes while that patient remains in seizure and they're not being adequately oxygenated means potential brain damage. So get the heck out of there. All right. Gestational diabetes. So this happens in a number of pregnancies, and so any altered mental status, we're going to check blood sugar in mom and administer dextrose if indicated, or glucagon if we're not able to get IV access. And D50 is always your best option because it's quick. And neuromuscular disorders, this is a rare occurrence. I've never had a pregnant patient with a neuromuscular disorder, but it can happen. And trust me, mom will tell you, because her vaginal birth is probably not an option for her. So she's probably looking at C-section, and she's calling you because she's in labor and too weak to move, too, you know, not safe to move. And don't ever think that pregnant moms and laborers should just take Uber or cab. That's not a good idea. I mean, think about it. If you were pregnant alone, would you want to take a cab? I wouldn't. Dirty cab, dirty Uber, with some unqualified driver, no way, right? So myasthenia gravis is one example of, it's a rare neurological disorder, but less rare than perhaps some of the others. It's an autoimmune disorder that destroys the acetylcholine receptors, and as a consequence, they develop a slow muscular weakness over time, at least the skeletal muscle weakness, and possibly even muscle weakness, the respiratory system, so they may have some difficulty breathing. Pretty rare, so it happens in 20,000 to 40,000 pregnancies. And believe me, when mom and dad, in most cases, you know, when she's trying to get pregnant, they've done a lot of consideration with this beforehand and know the risks. So it's very highly unlikely that you'll ever get called for this sort of thing, because she's probably hospitalized well before her term. Antepartum exacerbations are common, about 41% in one study. And assessments, respiratory assessment is critical. So if she doesn't have the strength of her respiratory muscles to breathe adequately, you're probably going to see that reflected in a low saturation. If you have the luxury of an end-tidal CO2 detector, where do you think her end-tidal CO2 might be if she has poor respiratory drive? Low, normal, high.
High.
Yeah, high. So it's probably CO2 retention, right? If she's not able to, if she doesn't have adequate minute volume rate and tidal volume. She may be short of breath, she might be dyspneic, so we want to assess respiratory rate and roughly gauge tidal volume. SpO2 level of awareness, not likely to have the strength to push to deliver a baby. So if you get a mom with myasthenia gravis and she's feeling the urge to push, if she's crowning, I might even just transport while she's crowning, because I don't know if that delivery is going to happen. I feel like most, in every other case, you would stay at the scene and deliver the baby, but I'll be honest, this one scares the crap out of me. So I'd be making movements to get on that stretcher and maybe deliver in the back of the ambulance, and I'd be on the phone to the base hospital doc saying, what do I do? The base hospital doc will say, I'm an emerge doc, I'm not an obstetrician, don't ask me. And I'll say, well, can you patch me through to an obstetrician? I'm in dire straits here. I've never met a medic who's had to deal with a neuromuscular disease in a pregnant patient, but I'm sure if I did a poll on Facebook or something, I might find someone. So management, SpO2, ECG, O2, PRN, PPV, PRN, lateral recumbent, right, for supine hypertension, IV TKO transport. Placenta previa, so this is, and I'm not telling you anything you can't just review through the notes, but hopefully adding a caveat here and there that might be helpful. So I've had calls for placenta previa. I've also had calls for abruptio placenta. And the bottom line is, if you get that call information over dispatch, just get there quickly and get out quickly. Like, don't waste any time. History, I'll take it all in the back of the ambulance. You have a history of placenta previa, it's all I need to know. I can find out everything else elsewhere. It's not a lab scenario, you know, where you're going to take your time. And, do you have any other medical conditions you're being treated for? Do you have, you know, medications? You know what medications you're on? No. get out of there. Get a list of meds from someone. Get everything in the back of the hands. That's what I would say. That's my personal advice. So with placentopenia, sometimes it presents with painless vaginal bleeding in the third trimester. So when you hear vaginal bleeding, ask, is it painful or painless? We don't do vaginal exams. We treat for shock, rapid transport, and that's it. That's what placentopenia looks like. So you can see the first one there, total placentopenia. You're probably not going to birth that baby and the placenta simultaneously. If you do, it's going to be like hemorrhage exsanguination time. It's not a good situation. How many women in this class never want to have a baby now? You haven't already had one.
Well,
Jack.
Jake, sorry.
Well, I did, but I said women. But.
I have a man.
Well, you know what? You know what it tells me, Jake? It tells me you're a really sensitive guy, and you would not want any woman that you love to go through that kind of suffering. You're a good man.
Thank you.
Yeah. What's that?
My mom.
She did.
Yeah.
Any more stories or?
Yeah.
I was in emergency C-section.
Oh, okay. And have you worked out?
Yeah.
Look at her. Yeah, that's awesome. You're going to tell mom when we talked about it before, previous? Yeah. Did you go to hospital early?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, hopefully this makes you more empathetic to your mom who had to go through this.
Oh, she went through like 5 years of fertility treatment to get pregnant with me.
Oh.
So it's a fight usually.
Yeah.
I had to fight to have you, so you better get
you. Yes, you do. So you better be good, you better behave, you better do this. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
That's way too much pressure. I would just say, Mom, I'm here.
I know.
Everything that happened to get me here, that's your issue. I'm just here.
It's funny, we tell her too.
No more pressure. No more pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want me to talk to your mom, let me know.
Okay.
So treatment for shock, SpO2 ECG, O2 PRN, left lateral recumbent, IV fluids, PRN. It's all the same stuff, right? Supportive care. Minimal scene time, that's the key. Recognize something that's potentially life-threatening and get the hell out of it. That's the key. That's what distinguishes a clinician, someone medically trained, from someone who is not medically trained. It's not always what you do, it's what you can recognize, right? It's you understanding the pathophysiology of something like placentopenia and a rupture of placenta, recognizing it's potentially life-threatening, even if everything seems fine, and getting the hell out of there. The classic one of recognizing the difference between life and death, to me, is like the Tylenol overdose, who's 6 hours post-Tylenol overdose. And a lethal dose in most adults is 14 grams. That's just 28 extra strength Tylenols. And those patients have maybe a little bit of abdominal discomfort. If not, they may be completely asymptomatic. And otherwise, they're perfectly fine. And we get there, and police and fire, everything's fine, he's fine. And then we leave lights and sirens, and they're standing there shaking their heads like, why do they leave lights and sirens? Because we know Tylenol will kill you. And there's a very narrow window to get the antidote. If you don't get that antidote soon, they're going to die. Not only are they going to die, they're going to die in 4 to 5 days. It's going to be the most excruciating death imaginable because your liver fails and it's painful. So my point is, that's the distinction between you and someone who's not medically trained. You recognize what's life-threatening. You know how to deal with it. You know that there's no dilly-dallying at the scene. And you get the history in the back of the annals. Okay, abruptio placenta. So that's a premature separation of the normally implanted placenta. Frequency is about 1% of pregnancies, which means you get 100 pregnancy patients, you're going to get at least one. If you're working in Northern Ontario, you get a lot of pregnancies, you're going to be higher than 1%. So that's a life threat to mom and the fetus. Maternal death and fetal death may occur because of hemorrhage and coagulopathy. Fetal mortality is about 15%. And abruptio placenta is classified as partial, severe, or complete. That's what it looks like. So in two of the cases, partial and complete, where it's up here, the bleeding is what they call occult, meaning we don't see it. It's hidden for much. If there's vaginal bleeding, okay, vaginal bleeding, everyone knows. Blood coming out of there, not good. Let's get out of here. So signs and symptoms may vary. Patients can have the following symptoms. Vaginal bleeding, about 80% of the cases. Abdominal and back pain, tenderness, 70%. Fetal distress, 60%. Although we're not likely to assess that, and that's why I put a star to it. Abnormal uterine contractions, sort of either hypertonic, high frequency, or 35%. Idiopathic premature labor. Yep.
If you have a patient who's had a hysterectomy, what is your main concern with your data?
That she has abdo pain. That's it, honestly. Okay. Hysterectomy. You don't know. It depends on, you know, the onset, the severity, constant, intermittent. You know, the objective is to determine whether this is something potentially life-threatening or non-threatening. The bad news about abdominal pain is so much of it is so vague, it's impossible to make any sort of clinical diagnosis or even narrow it down. The good thing about abdominal pain is if it's sudden, if it's severe, if it's constant, doesn't matter what it is, it's life-threatening until proven otherwise. Sudden, severe, constant. Those are three things you gotta know. Those are key things. Okay, abrupt Joe. Causes. Maternal hypertension, maternal trauma, cigarette smoking, alcohol consumption, cocaine use, short umbilical cord. Nothing you can do about that. Premature ruptured membranes, delivery of first twin. Retroplacental fibromyoma, advanced maternal age, so over 35. And last but not least, probably most common, idiopathic, so we don't know why. Management?
You got 10 minutes, we're just...
Getting restless?
I'll be in. Yeah, I was going to use different words, but...
Okay. So treat for shock, the usual stuff, right? Premature labor, now this is the important stuff where you should have your notebook set. Pick your tired brain on it. it's okay, if you can lock it all up there, you know, that's fine. So premature labor, we're usually talking between 20 and 37 weeks. Happens about 12% of pregnancies. It's a leading cause of neonatal mortality. Premature rupturing in the membranes is associated with 30 to 40% of preterm deliveries. It's a leading cause of identifiable cause of preterm delivery. So those patients will sometimes go to the hospital and get their cervix stitched to prevent the progression of the pregnancy and effacement. Sometimes they'll get put on magnesium to relax the uterus. Risk factors include smoking, previous term delivery, other vaginal bleeding at any time during the pregnancy. That we don't need to talk about, you just review that. Precipitating factors include infection, vaginosis, STIs or STDs, UTIs, etc. Uterine distension, multiple gestations, polyhydramnios, uterine distortion, incontinent cervix, abrupt placenta, placenta previa. So add to the complications, low two situations, HTN, IDDM. IDDM stands for, I gotta sit down, sorry, I'm getting tired. Yeah, insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, good, IDDM. So NIDDM would be non-insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. We usually typically describe patients in our charts as IDDM or NIDDM. Now, type 2 diabetics are later, you know, age-onset diabetics. Type 2s can be NIDDM, most are NIDDM, but type 2s can progress to IDDM. So if they're type 2 and if they're insulin-dependent, first of all, ask them, have you had diabetes since childhood or is this later in life? And if they say later in life, then we call it type 2 IDDM. Or is this gestational? So preterm, some precipitating factors, cardiovascular disease, renal disease, medical previous history of preterm, multiparous traumas, so lots and lots of different causes, right? Drug abuse, smoking, alcohol consumption, stressful life, so things like domestic violence, close family death, insecurity over food, home, or partner. There's been some recent theory about the role of the fetus. You know, if the fetus gets distressed, you know, picture the fetus saying, let me the hell out of here. And there's been some discussion about future tocolytic therapy. Tocolytic means a drug that stops labor, being directed at modifying fetal response. I'm not sure what that means. It sounds like sedation of the fetus to me. Like, honestly, I don't know what that means. It does, don't you think? Like, the fetus is distressed. How do you settle it down? I don't know. It might be nutritional, might be some other factor. You know, nitroglycerin is a tocolytic. Did we have this discussion? We have this discussion. Nitroglycerin actually relaxes the uterus in pregnancy. Did you know this? I didn't know it either until my wife had a C-section, and the obstetrician asked the anesthetist to give nitro. Did I tell you this story? No, I didn't tell you. And the anesthetist was a buddy of mine. We taught ACLS together. And he said, Rob, you're the paramedic. You give your wife some nitro. And I said, okay. So I'm telling my wife what I'm going to do. And then I go to spray it under her tongue, and she starts talking. So I sprayed it on her chin by mistake. I said, for God's sakes, I got to do this again. Just keep your mouth open and lift your tongue up. I'm going to try it again. So I got it in. And she was pissed at me already because I'm chatting away with Brian, and she looks at me, she says, Rob, they're cutting me open to get our baby. Can you pay a little more attention to me? Can you, like, Brian, have a coffee later or something? And so I said, okay, I'm sorry. So anyway, to this day, you know, she razzes me every once in a while. If I'm going out on shift, she'll say, oh, and by the way, if you have any patients with chest pain, make sure the nitro goes under the tongue. No. Yeah, so I didn't know it was a tocolytic. So in terms of management for premature labor, just know the most important thing is, well, one, the delivery may happen quickly, so anticipate that. Number two, if you're delivering a preemie, you're going to deliver a baby who may not be breathing adequately, so you may have to resuscitate. We'll talk about that later. If mom's dead, we work on resuscitating mom. That's really all it boils down to. We don't call for TORS, termination resuscitation. If mom's in cardiac arrest, we do CPR on mom. We get the hell out of there. C-section would have to be performed really quickly in hospital. Not likely to happen. Baby's not likely to survive. I've never heard of a pregnant woman who's dead whose baby survived. I did have a pregnant patient once who was in a slow speed motor vehicle collision, and even at slow speed, like 60 kilometers an hour, the weight of a fully gravid uterus in third trimester propelling forward at that speed and getting knocked back from the airbag and just the impact can cause tearing of mesenteric vessels. And she bled to death within an hour and a half. And we weren't able to transport her. They had to take her up to the OR. They did an emergency C-section of the baby. Baby survived, mom died. But that's the only case I've ever heard of a dead pregnant woman whose baby survived. So, anyone want to stay back and ask questions for the next 30 minutes or so?
30 minutes? What do you mean? Oh, you only have four.
Brother Cassio, yes.
Question.
Yeah.
Do most trucks now have a ETCO2 monitor for even
nasopharynx? I'm going to say I don't think so, but I don't know for certain.
Not really.
I would say maybe fewer than 5% of services have side stream entitled CO2. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully that'll improve over time.